Hi, I'm Skating PJ, and this is Let's Talk About It, the Skate Ontario podcast, where we're going to get up close and personal with members of our skating family who have a connection to Ontario. So, let's talk about it. Hi, everybody. At Skating PJ here with another fantastic episode of Let's Talk About It, the Skate Ontario podcast. And today I am thrilled to welcome author and friend Philippa Cranston Barron, who is the author of this fantastic book about a Skate Ontario legend, Taller Cranston, Ice Paint Passion. Philippa, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, PJ. I'm delighted to be here.
So you are one of four children. You're the oldest, right? You were like the shepherdess of the flock.
Yes.
I want to talk a little bit about Little Taller Cranston. Going way back, this is a picture of you and your brother together. So talk to me about what life was like in your family. There's you, your brother Taller, and then twin brothers as well. But we're going to focus on Taller, skating legend, art legend, who of course passed away. It's now 9 years ago, is it not?
Yes, 2015.
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
When he passed away, it was during the Canadian National Figure Skating Championships, as the men's free program was about to get underway. I mean, what is the timing? Because we were all together in Kingston, Ontario. And then word went through the building like that. I was in the building covering it for CBC. And then it just was unbelievable. We couldn't believe that Taller was gone. So we're going to get to that, but let's go back to the beginning. Talk to me about life in the Cranston household.
Well, we were the most ordinary middle-class family one could imagine, typical of families all across Canada. Stay-at-home mom who was very active in the community and a theatrical drama queen. Guess where Taller got his flair? And my father, who was the nicest, most decent man in the entire world, worked for a mining equipment company. So we lived in always Ontario, Southern Ontario, and Galt, which is now Cambridge, although it will always be Galt for me, and a number of years in Kirkland Lake in Northern Ontario. And just incredibly, incredibly normal, with the tiny exception that Taller did have an imaginary friend called Glunk Glunk. I don't ever know exactly what Glunk Glunk looked like, but I do know that somebody was always stepping on Glunk Glunk and Taller would be screamingly indignant about that. We did our chores. We fed the dog. We, you know, got a little tiny allowance. It was incredibly, incredibly normal. There were expectations. We were expected to do our homework, expected to make our bed. But it was a household where we were encouraged to do, to be the best we could be, even from a very young age. My mother was a wonderful reader, and we grew up on every imaginable thread of children's literature, everything from fairy tales to Grimm to Hans Christian Andersen, Winnie the Pooh, Charlotte's Web. And I believe that that magical, whimsical charm, witches, potions, fairies, pixies, and stuff are kind of present in Taller's painting, maybe in his personality, certainly to some extent, I think, in his skating. But as a little boy, he was just pretty normal, obnoxious, temperamental younger brother. He once threw scissors at me and cut me in the eye, but happily I did not lose the eye. And he once kicked me with his skates, and I still bear the scar on my left leg because I refused to twirl him. And I imagine that he carried a few scars from me too. So it was pretty good. But I can tell you about how he discovered skating as a 6 year old, probably 6-7 year old.
He announced that was my question.
Okay, he announced that he would like to do ballet. And we were living in Swastika in Northern Ontario, tiny little place. It's still a tiny little place. Wonderful, beautiful. We were taken to the ballet studio in the basement of the Fireman's Hall in Kirkland Lake. And Taller learned at the age of 6 in lesson 1 that men didn't get to wear, boys didn't get to wear toe shoes. And therefore, he wouldn't be able to twirl and leap on his toes as Margot Fonteyn would have. And that was very distressing to him, and that was the end of ballet. But shortly thereafter, he was brought to a Kirkland Lake skating club carnival and saw figure skating and says that he turned to my mother and said, "That's what I want. That's exactly what I want." And that was figure skating. And that is where it started, on an outdoor rink in minus 300 degree weather in Northern Ontario. In my old skates, he began to skate. And from a very early age, clearly showed a commitment, a dedication, a passion, a discipline, and a capacity to learn and strive to get better. And the creativity was there, I would say, right from the very beginning.
So here is an early skating club carnival. This is called the Blueprints.
Yes.
Now, did you skate as well?
I did, but, you know, like most people, I was never terribly good. But, you know, girls figure skated and boys played hockey, and occasionally boys did figure skating, and occasionally girls played hockey. But that picture, it makes me laugh. I remember exactly where it was taken in our house, and my mother had made this costume out of pale blue satin, pale blue tights, and sewed these sequins on, a cunning little vine shape. But yeah, I remember he skated to Russian saber dance, I think, even in that costume, and came out doing mad shoot the ducks and furious Russian splits and stuff at the age of 7.
Do you know what's so amazing? You talk about normal, okay?
Yeah.
And your vision of normal and a normal family and, you know, making your bed and doing your chores and whatever else. But you know, I've often talked to you about Toller and about him being sort of basically a rare exotic bird. And to imagine a rare exotic bird in Kirkland Lake, Ontario, he must have stood out in a dramatic way, I am thinking. But tell me about that.
I honestly don't think he did. He was certainly, he was a decent student, not awful, not... No, honestly, he was incredibly normal. Where he stood out, it wasn't in the unusualness that he came to be known for and revered for, and which he certainly cultivated over his lifetime, but he was very talented. So even as a little boy, a little bit older, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, he was a really talented diver. He was outstanding in track and field. He clearly wasn't really cut out for team sports, although he could have done anything, I think. But he could have been a competitive diver, or he could have been pole vault, high jump were the things that he liked in track and field. But it was figure skating that kind of took his heart and pretty soon took his time and very soon took all the money that the family had, too. But it was skating that did. But no, it wasn't that he would do unusual things, but he would do it in a normal kind of context. So we'd be building sandcastles on the beach. His would probably have some elaborate turret, but it was still building sandcastles with all the kids on the beach. No, he was pretty normal. And I actually think that's why the appeal and the fondness and the respect and the affection for Toller nationwide still exists, was because he, at the heart of it, people knew he was just incredibly normal. He was vulnerable. You've said yourself in the wonderful opening that you did for the book that, you know, he was shy. He was a little bit shy. He was quite vulnerable. And that came through. So he could perform. He was a performer for sure. And he was over the top. But that was his public persona that he created for himself. And he talked about that pretty openly as an adult. As a kid, honestly couldn't have been more normal.
I was going to say, it's fascinating to me because when I look at a picture like this, and you were so generous to share some pictures of your family, like here's a tea party picture.
Yes.
By the way, who of our generation did not have a smock dress? That's what I want to know.
I think it is sadly maybe like Toller skating style, a lost art. I don't know of anybody who's smocking anymore. I don't even know if Walmart carries fake Chinese smock, but I had a bunch of them. My mother smocked, my aunt Auntie Barb smocked, everybody smocked. And those were beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful. They were.
So is it possible that Toller would come to my tea party? No, as the older sister, he was probably commanded to come, and he showed up. And I also remember that ribbon in my hair. My mother would pull my hair so it would feel like it was coming out of my scalp. But she would say, "You have to suffer to be beautiful," she would say. So whenever I see that hair ribbon, all I can feel is my hair being yanked.
So as you're sort of, you know, Toller eventually moves to Toronto, you know, has this career that is supported and encouraged by Ellen Burka, legendary coach. What was the family dynamic like? Was he removed from what was going on in your family at that time? Was he still part of it? Tell me about that. Of course.
You know, my mother was a drama queen, so was Toller in some way. So, of course, there were clashes, but I had clashes with my parents because I was turning into a kind of left-wing hippie going to UCLA and having fights with my father about Richard Nixon. It was normal sort of late 60s stuff, I think, for any family. But he, by the time he was 13, 14, he was summer skating, which was quite unusual in those days. He would go to the town of Mount Royal usually, and he was competing at the national level when he was 15, 16, but the judges, the authority, the establishment couldn't abide this flamboyant peacock, even though he was poured into monkey suits or, you know, standard tuxedo kind of in those days. But I think he was 18 when he was working at Lake Placid the summer when he was 18, and he just had a hideous Canadian championships in Vancouver where he got marks from first to dead last. There were 22 or 26 skaters, and his marks were first to 26 because the judges didn't know what to do with them. But he tells the story, and Ellen Burka tells the story as well, that after this competition, she came upon him sobbing underneath the stands in the Vancouver arena and said, don't worry, your time will come. You know, they know what they saw and it's going to be okay. And that would have been in March, April or January, whenever Canadians are. But that summer he was in Lake Placid working as the groundskeeper at the Mirror Lake Inn. And he called Ellen Burka from a payphone in the Lake Placid arena and said, "This is Toller Cranston. Do you remember me? Will you teach me?" And because he knew he wasn't going to get anywhere skating out of Montreal. And he admits that that's an awkward thing to say, but back in those days, that's kind of how it was. That all the skaters came from the Cricket Club or the Granite Club. Occasionally somebody from Vancouver would squeak in, but mostly it was a different hierarchical system, and that's how it went. Anyway, Ellen Burka, according to Toller, Ellen had to canvass her students as to whether or not they would consent to her taking on Toller Cranston, and they apparently said, maybe Toller made this up, but it makes a good story, and I'm always up for a good story, too, that Ellen's student said, "Well, Toller's so fat and out of shape and useless, we don't have any problems, so sure, go ahead." And she pretty quickly whipped him into shape. They found each other at that time, 18, 19, and within a year or so, he was a national champion, and the rest is history.
You know what's so interesting? You know, you and I've talked about the fact that, you know, I was 10 years younger than Toller, and certainly not in the same league in terms of talent, not even should have been on the same page of the book. But what I will tell you is that some of the things that were legendary is I do remember some fairly loud, we'll call them disagreements between Toller and Mrs. Burka. I don't think in my sort of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant upbringing that I had ever seen arguments like that. But it doesn't sound like that was what Toller was necessarily, except for, you know, trying to kick you, and, you know, maybe throw scissors at you, that was necessarily his personality, that mercurial. So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, that's extraordinary. And I've not even heard that before. Of course, it doesn't surprise me that there were frictions between Ellen and Toller. They were both pretty forceful personalities, but I think at the heart of it all, they were very much on the same wavelength. I know Ellen viewed Toller as her instrument, that through Toller she could express what she wanted in skating. And he, for her, through her vision and encouragement, permitted him to express himself the way he'd imagined he could do as a six-year-old or in his Blue Prince costume. So I never witnessed any friction, but Toller, throughout his entire life, had massive falling outs with almost everyone he ever met. And in some cases, it were people, that's hard for my English brain. In some cases, it was people who were trying to get something from him, take something from him. There were a lot of people from the time he was little there were takers and people that just wanted to bleed him dry, take his time, take his attention, and fill his ear full of nonsense about other people. In other cases, sometimes people were selfish, but he was also a bit of a prick sometimes, quite honestly, and he could turn on people on a dime, and he did. With Ellen, I don't know what the disagreements were about, but it maybe were personal frustrations or whatever was going on in either of their lives. I don't know. I know that Toller has never said a word about Ellen Burka that wasn't with utmost respect and admiration. So if they had folks on the ice, I don't know if it was about an arm movement at a moment in the music or if it was just because somebody was tired and cranky that day. That's news to me. I don't know. But I do know that he had tempestuous relationships with pretty much everyone in his whole life, including probably his parents, with the one exception, who would have been Hai Gunjin, who was the British skating champion at the time. And I say in the book, is the only person with whom Toller never had a falling out. That's just how he was. And often I could rhyme off a list of skaters. It would be like the Little Black Book of Ontario skaters. And people would say, Toller and I didn't speak to each other for a year or for 2 years, or we had a fight or whatever. But they always seemed to come back together at some point where there was mutual respect and admiration. Those things got repaired. And when he died, they just got swept aside. People have remembered him with affection, with humor, with admiration, and with, you know, great furious indignation about how awful he'd been to them sometimes. But it was always said with so much affection. I thought he must surely be the luckiest person in the whole world to have behaved that badly with so many people and to have had them overlook it at some point. He was lucky.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about sort of those early years as an artist, and you sent me this picture. First of all, it reminds me of his split jump. Yeah. But is this a picture that Toller did?
Yes, that's a picture that Toller did. I think he was about 7, and he said that the S on the front of the skater stood for skating, and those things at the back were spotlights. And he writes about his little hat, which also has an S on it, S for skating. But my mother used to knit him these little toques, little tiny hats with little tiny pom-poms, and so that was a kind of tribute to her, if he'd thought about doing a tribute at the age of 7. But anyway, yes, that is an original, and I find it amazing because the style, you can kind of recognize it. I mean, obviously his technique improved somewhat in the next 60 years, but it was there. So clearly, the stardom, the lights, the spotlight, the flamboyance, the, you know, performance aspect was very appealing to him, but also the artistic thing. He drew that picture.
Do you feel, so Toller used to talk about being an artist who skated.
Yes.
Many people who knew him just from skating knew of him as a skater who painted.
Yes.
Which statement do you think more clearly defines him?
Oh, 100%, 100% artist who happened to skate. On his tombstone in Mexico, I put only Toller artist. I didn't put Cranston. I didn't put skater. I didn't put Olympian. I didn't put painter, even though in San Miguel, Mexico, where he died, where he lived for the last 23 years of his life, he was certainly known as an artist. Very few people even knew that he skated. He was an artist through and through. He was an artist in his soul, an artist in his bones. He was an artist in everything he did. And his mantra and how he lived and how he tried to inspire or set an example for other people was about being creative in whatever way one can, in whatever field one can. The creativity, pushing boundaries, being authentic, staying true to oneself, working hard. That's what he was all about. So he would have wanted to be known simply as an artist. Harold Town once called him a Sunday painter, and Toller took great offense at that. That would have been back in the 70s, maybe. And that's always stuck in my craw, too, because I like to think probably more people today in Canada would recognize the name Toller Cranston than Harold Town. Look it up, ladies and gentlemen.
I was going to say Harold who? But that was my thing. Now, I'm a little bit curious about the name Toller. He's the only Toller I have ever known, ever. Where does the name come from?
Well, it's a family name. My grandmother's maiden name was Toller. She was Mary Frances Toller. The Tollers came from England years ago, and they set up along the actually on the Ottawa River in West Quebec. They were lumbering barons, lumber families, and so it's a family name.
Wow.
English origin, and it's a family name. But I get Google alerts for Toller, and I quite often there's some kind of Toller town in England called Toller, East Toller, Little Toller, Big Toller, whatever, and somebody's always robbing something or having an accident in Toller. So I get these Google alerts. And there are also a breed of dog called duck tolling retrievers, which are popularly called Toller. So there are Tollers here and there, but Toller is a family name.
They're called duck tollers.
Yeah.
Not Tollers, right. Tollers.
Well, I can't bring myself to say Toller
I know.
But yeah, duck tolling retrievers. But Google doesn't recognize Toller or Toller. And so I get alerts for the dogs. I think that would please Toller too.
I think there's something about that that is somehow fitting. It's kind of like Cher. There's only one. Only ever one Toller. You know, the other thing that I think is remarkable about his style is that I love the fact that he was insistent on his timing. In other words, so some creative people, you know, are yakety, 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 very fast, and you sort of have to run to keep up with them. And I always felt in any conversation that I ever had with Toller, and again, it's not that I knew him very well, but I certainly crossed paths with him all the way up until he died, but he would make you wait for him. If there was a thought that he wanted to express, if there was something that he was working on, he wouldn't rush through it. So if you had to wait, so be it. I think that that kind of artistic temperament is a very interesting one, because often creative people are in a huge rush to get it out of their system, whatever it is that's that itch that they want to scratch. But was there that kind of thoughtfulness, let's say, that kind of consideration as a young kid as well?
Well, I actually think it's very considerate and kind of you to put it in terms of Toller making people wait, because other people would have described it as arrogance and selfishness. And I think there was an element of that in him too. And certainly a performance thing where, you know, he'd be a bit of a diva and make people wait. Artistically, I think there wasn't a false bone in his body or a false gene, that he worked very, very hard to learn more, learn better, do better, absorb more, express more. And he was pretty honest. He said once that if he were offered, I don't know what he said, $100 million or a unlimited amount of money, if he could take the money and not be creative for another day in his life. And he said there would be no hesitation whatsoever. Being creative, having the luxury to be creative and to work at being creative every day was what he treasured the most. So that often would result in what would appear to be selfishness, being late, leaving abruptly, setting up an appointment and bailing. It still embarrasses me terribly when skating clubs back in the day would have invited him to skate and he'd often like not show up or not confirm or simply change his mind. It's embarrassing. We were raised to mind our P's and Q's a bit more, but I think he just couldn't sometimes. He just couldn't do it.
I'm going to go on the record with something that I've been thinking about for a while since you and I have talked about that very thing. I honestly think that in his mind, he felt the pain of bailing would be less for the people that were waiting for him than the pain of him not being what they expected, or at least what he thought in his mind was what they expected.
I'm
going to go on the record to say that, you know what, when you're creative, you have certainly a very different kind of brain from the rest of the world. That's for sure. But I also believe that the idea of not showing up at, you know, in complete Toller bestness, there's a word, that the pain of that to the people who were expecting him would have been greater than him bailing in his mind. So that's what I honestly believe.
No, I think that's exactly right. And there's a wonderful story that I've been telling, especially now I live in the Ottawa Valley community of Arnprior, which I know you're familiar with. Eastern Ontario is such a glorious part of Canada. Taller was invited to come, and when the Civic Center in 1976, I think, opened in Arnprior, my Uncle Hugh had been the mayor of Arnprior, and they invited Taller to come and skate. It was the first time he was invited to come to Arnprior. So 76, he would have already, probably was an Olympic year. It was the year he won his Olympic medal, Olympic bronze medal. Anyway, he came to Arnprior. It's a small community, less than 5,000 people in those days, to perform for the opening of the Civic Center. And he wrote about how incredibly nervous he was, because he was aware that in Arnprior they wouldn't get, and still don't, and still haven't, get many skaters of very high quality coming through the town. Yep. And he felt it was incumbent on him to perform as though Arnprior was Madison Square Garden that day. So getting back to what you said, PJ, I think it's exactly right. If he didn't feel that he could give them a Madison Square Garden level performance, then he would bail. In the case of Arnprior, he didn't bail. He did show up. Every single person in town was there. And now 30, 40, 50 years later, almost, they're still talking about, I saw Taller Cranston in the Arnprior when the Nick Smith Center opened. So he said it's about creating a moment, and he wanted to give a moment that people would remember.
Yeah.
And I so
and
respect
nothing less.
That. Yeah, nothing less.
I think you should forgive yourself and not be embarrassed any longer, because the insanity of not showing up actually came from the right place.
I think it did, but it doesn't help if you're organizing a skating
park. Believe me. As an organizer of the grocery show with my friend Tricia Morgan, we sent a car to make sure that he would show up. Yes. Bless his heart. Okay, I want to turn the corner, because we don't have a whole ton of time, but this is really important, and that is the creation of this book. I know where I was when Taller died. I want you to walk me through those first moments, that first few months. What was it really like? It was a lot for you, I know.
It was absolutely unreal. I got a phone call. It's amazing to me that picture is more than 50 years old. It's pretty incredible. And yet anybody who ever saw Taller Cranston skate would recognize that instantly.
Absolutely.
I got a phone call saying, I heard your brother died. Is that true? And I thought, oh, geez, I don't know. It was on a Saturday afternoon in January 2015. But a friend of mine, a fellow bridge player I knew, was at the national championships in Kingston. And I called her and said, I just heard that my brother died. Do you have any way to confirm that? She said, oh, my God, you won't believe it, because the news had just hit Kingston where you were. So nobody in Canada knew. He died the evening before. He had a massive heart attack in his studio and collapsed and wasn't discovered until he died instantly, the coroner said, which is merciful, but he wasn't discovered by his staff until the Saturday, and then the news came to Canada. So I got it kind of by the grapevine, by the internet, by the phone call, like everybody did. And then I waited for a day or two to see, you know, listening, what were the arrangements going to be, because he'd been living in Mexico for 23 years, and I assumed that somehow it would get looked after and I'd be informed, but there wasn't any information. It took 48 hours or so. And finally, with the help of our niece, who's a criminal lawyer in Kingston, as a matter of fact, she said, no, you need to call the embassy, call external affairs and call, you know, find out what's going on. So I did, and discovered that my brother was in a morgue in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico. And I mean, obviously this is unthinkable and awful. So within a couple of days, with the help and support of external affairs, the Canadian embassy, Canadian ambassador in Mexico, I went to Mexico to get him looked after. And that's like at the most practical level, that's what was going on. And that meant introducing myself to his staff, to his friends, to his whole entire scene in Mexico, and learning who was who and what was what, and finding a plot and deciding arrangements and so on. But I also, my husband Dan and I talked within 24 hours of getting the news that Taller had died, was that we knew instantly that it was our job, it would fall to us to ensure that he wouldn't be forgotten, that he would be remembered and acknowledged as an important Canadian, an icon, a legend, and not just because of the skating or the painting, but because of the work ethic, because of the courage, because of the insistence on authenticity, as we've talked about. And so I knew that I had a job to do, but I also had a lot of mechanical stuff to get through. And that was a long, complicated, difficult, challenging, sometimes hysterically funny story that went on until about 3 weeks ago. And that will, I think, be a major motion picture at some point. But anyway, so there were legal challenges, logistical challenges, working to settle his affairs and organize his affairs in two countries was difficult. It took a long time, but also incredibly satisfying to do it in a way that respected him, his reputation, what he'd worked for, that respected the people that had bought and collected his paintings and supported him over the years, that respected his fellow competitors and the legacy that he had established in Canada and in Ontario, that respected the staff that would have died for him every single day of their lives. They were the most devoted, amazing people in the world, and that respected his love of Mexico and his love of Canada. Some idiot wrote an article in Mexico about how Toller hated skating and Toller didn't like Canada and didn't hated his family and so on and so on. It was utterly ridiculous. Toller was a proud Canadian from the day he was born till the day he died. And so it was important to me to kind of balance all those things and walk a bunch of tight ropes. But I think with the success of this book, which is very gratifying, it seems to have worked. And it was important to me with this book that a third of his life was in Mexico. So there needed to be a Mexican presence in the book. And I think that's there. The impact that Toller had on his world in Mexico, on the community of San Miguel de Allende, on his staff, on their families. I'm very, very proud of, I'm proud of him for that. And he has left a mark and he won't be forgotten.
So, Philippa, let's talk for a moment. Where was that moment that you said, this needs to be a book? Because I know that you were also consumed with, you know, you had to, you know, lots of people who have relatives who've died have had to do this, but you had to clean out his place. You had to, you know, catalog and ship all of those pieces of art. And they numbered in the thousands, I think, if you told me that correctly.
I did.
So, you know, there's this huge job plus trying to figure out just, you know, where are we at and what is this all about? And then you decide when or how or what was that initial thought that said this needs to be a book?
Well, I don't even think it was a thought. I think it was just there. It was clear to me that it had to be. I'm a writer. I make my living as a writer, mostly for film and television, or did in those days. And so the idea of writing isn't strange to me. And the idea of telling stories is certainly not strange to me. And I know you would relate to that as well. So it was clear that there had to be a, I wanted something that would be left with Canadians to remind people of the image that's on that, on the cover of that book, which to me is is everything. It's the flamboyance. It's the, you know, if you move that picture to the end, you know, to the left, to the right, up or down, it changes totally. But that way, it's like Toller saying, this is me. At least that's what we thought. Anyway, but I didn't know, I had absolutely no clue how it was going to work. And so what I did was, first of all, accept that I know nothing of any quality about figure skating, the politics of judging. Toller certainly grew up in the worst area of politics of figure skating judging. I wouldn't presume to write about that. I wouldn't presume to write about LGBT issues. I wouldn't presume to write about out or openly out or closeted or whatever. I wouldn't presume to write about contemporary art, but I could presume to write about Toller as a little boy, and I could presume to write about the other things that I knew about. So what I did was invite people who had the quality, the experience, the knowledge, the perspective to write about those things that I couldn't. And the very first person was PJ Kwong, who was there in the press room in Kingston when yep. that very dramatic announcement was made. And then I thought to myself as the months went by, oh, this is a really clever idea, because if this book never finds a publisher or never gets out, at least PJ will want a copy for her family. And so I'll ask more people. So I enlisted Debbie Wilkes to write about the figure skating, and Barbara Berezowski wrote an absolutely wonderful piece about that sort of transitions about the figure skating judging and how Toller threw his skates into the canal in Sweden and in Gothenburg and the last, when he'd finished his last figures competition ever. And so I invited people, but along the way, I realized too that it was impossible to discuss Toller in any kind of linear way or any kind of this is how he was way, because he was multiple things to multiple people and multiple things on any given day, or given the light, given the mood, given the time. And so somehow the idea of having various perspectives and respecting people enough to let them tell the story in their own words seemed to me to be the smartest way to go about it. And then Robert Hughes, the designer here in Arnprior, who's an absolute genius, took all of these disparate bits and pieces, quotes from Toller, long passages from other people, bits and pieces from me, 250 photographs. And by the way, I think there are 32 photographers who've given consent to have their work in this book. And it's amazing. Not a single one asked to be paid. Not a single one asked for royalties. It was like everybody was honored to be part of the Toller family journey. And that's how I feel it is. And that's how it's turning out to be. And now that the book's been out for a few months, there's not a week that goes by that I'm not hearing even more stories. Incredibly amazing.
I have to ask you a question, and that is that I recommended to you my former boss at Pan Am Games, Sam Correa, to be the editor. I cannot imagine what it was like to receive all of these digital bits of paper, my own included, and being able to wrangle it into something. What kind of discussions did you and Sam have in order to turn this into a something?
He has been so fabulous. I actually just talked to him a couple of days ago because we've got the next book on the go. What I loved about him was that, and I'm so, so grateful, he was exactly the right person for this. But what gave me so much confidence was that, you know, I'd have an initial conversation with him years and years ago when, I forget how many, long time ago when we started. But then the next time we'd talk a couple of months later, he'd say, I really loved the part about the so-and-so. I really found the part about Glunk Glunk to be amazing. And he was the first person that had sat with this material and remembered. And that's when I knew that we were onto something. We were onto something that was real. So he had a perspective that I didn't have a lot of times. And he would ask really pointed questions. The organization of it, I think, was sort of in place by the time Sam came along. But he was an absolute genius. Some of the chapter titles are his. And he's just incredibly thoughtful, and I felt he'd fully committed to this process, and I felt that I had a real partner, and we shriek with laughter at lots of things and wrangle things out together. But after I was finished with the book, he was finished with the book. It had been proofread here umpteen times. Then it went to the publisher, and along the way, we did get a publisher, fabulous Ken White at Sutherland House and his team. And they did a final proofread, which resulted in 150 other changes that had to be made. And lest people think it was all typos, although there were a few that were just egregious, hideous things that had slipped through. Mostly it was bringing a consistency. So numbers were being written out. And if it was a Broadway show, it would be italicized. If it was a record album cover, it wouldn't, or I can't even remember now. But they imposed a consistency on the book that's just elevated it, made it cleaner, easier to read. And everybody who touched this project, every single person, I felt put their heart in it. And I feel like the pride and the love and affection and intelligence and experience of all those people are very much in this book. It's everything I could have wanted it to be.
So I have a couple of quick final questions before I let you go. And the first one is, what do you think is the gift that this book brings for you?
For me, for sure, it's hearing so many stories from so many people that fill out a much more colored, nuanced, maybe not nuanced, there wasn't anything nuanced about Toller, bolder, deeper, richer tapestry of his life. And an enormous gratitude and respect for the impact that he had on other people. I don't think that's something that I appreciated when I was just his sister for all those years, but I am constantly running into people who say, he changed my life. He made me braver. He made me stronger. He gave me the courage to try something. He made me believe I could do nursing and painting, or I could do two things at once. And he just encouraged me to be me. And these are people from all walks of life, from all parts of the country, in so many different areas. And it's the impact that he had on other people that make me the most proud, and for the knowledge of which I'm most grateful to have. Because I always knew he was talented, but I don't think I fully appreciated the impact he had on people, from his courage, his work ethic, the creativity, and the absolute insistence on being exactly who he was every day of his life. And we started this conversation, this vulnerable little boy who grew up on my old skates and rink in Northern Ontario, that kind of Northern Ontario is a part of his soul as well.
Well, and my final question is, what do you think is Toller's gift? I mean, he's an Ontario legend. We're so thrilled to have him as one of our legends, certainly from Skate Ontario. But what do you think, broad strokes, was Toller's gift to the world?
I think it was fearlessness. He said himself, follow your destiny and learn to live without inhibitions. And he tried to do that himself. So I think his gift to the world was just inspiring people to be bold, to take chances, to do the work. I know when he died, and there were thousands and thousands of messages on television and magazines and radio and newspaper all over the world. But people weren't saying, they weren't going on and on about his skating. They were going on and on about, he changed figure skating. He changed the world, changed lives. He did it through skating, and he did it through painting, but he did it through the force and through the absolute authenticity in terms of being a gay man, through that absolute authenticity too. He never let it stand in his way. He never explained. It wasn't really a factor for him, but I know for sure he was a role model and inspiration to LGBT performers in all kinds of areas. And this was at a time when, you know, things were very different back in the 70s. So I'm just really proud of the example he set, an example of courage, creativity, expression, authenticity, and Canadian.
You know what? That is an absolutely brilliant way to end this. If people want to find out where to get this book, where should they go?
They could go to any place they would normally get books. Chapters, Indigo, Barnes Noble, the library, Southern Amazon. House Publisher, Amazon. Absolutely. Yep. Amazon, you get it in a couple of days. The publisher, it might take an extra day. But it's available everywhere, and I'm extremely proud. And I've got a series of events. I'm going to Manitoba, to Winnipeg tomorrow, and then Northern Ontario later in the week. And we're just in the process of planning a BC tour for early August. And then I expect to be in the Maritimes in October for the Nationals. So bit by bit, slowly but surely, the Toller message will resound across the country. But in the meantime, yes, thank you so much for this opportunity. And I very much would love to hear from people who have Toller stories. I know that everyone does. And there's a new book in the works, so open to more stories.
And if people want to get a hold of you, it's your name, Philippa Barron, at gmail.com.
That's right.
PHILLIPPABARAN at gmail.com. And what can I say except thank you so much for taking the time? This has been fantastic. Philippa, thank you so much. I'm sure a lunch is in your future somewhere.
Thank you, PJ. It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Let's Talk About It, the Skate Ontario podcast. Don't forget to follow us on social media. I'm at Skating PJ. Until next time. Bye for now.